and WBAI.org on the web.
Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Marcia Pendleton, the producer and your host. We opened the program with the matchless talent of Tina Turner, who transitioned on Wednesday, May 24th, at the age of 83. She found her voice and shared that journey with others, lived a life of endless possibilities, and left us with a legacy that will be embraced by countless generations. Legacy, generosity, possibility, creating your own imprint. These are the pillars on which the upcoming conversation is based. We want to welcome to Backstage Stories, CEO of National Black Theater, one of our most beloved and influential arts institutions that has been centering Blackness for over 55 years. Welcome to Backstage Stories, Shade Lithcott.
So good to be here, Marcia. Thanks for having me.
And let's jump right in. I don't know whether people listening know this or not, but the National Black Theater was founded by Dr. Barbara Ann Teer, and you are her daughter. What was it like to grow up as the daughter of Barbara Ann Teer and in and around the groundbreaking theatrical institution that we know as National Black Theater?
What a beautiful question to start out with. Well, I will say, you know, growing up in Harlem in the 70s and 80s and at the National Black Theater was a wild ride. I mean, that is the first thing that comes to my mind. It's a wild ride, you know. The original company of National Black Theater, formulated so much of its pedagogy out of Dr. Teer's pursuit of understanding the science and secret to soul, of soul. And a part of her pursuit, and I think that what people don't realize about my mom was like, she was this insatiable, curious scientist of sorts. Like, mm-hmm. Very few people know she was she was a biology major before she ever majored in dance or arts. She really was. So she saw herself as like really a mad scientist. And in that, she wanted to understand the science and secret of soul. And a part of that exploration brought her and the company to Nigeria, Oshogbo in particular, to the Ocean Grove, in which, Abba Lowell, by the name of Chief Ifeyemi Eleburibon, gave the company this extraordinary reading, which was that this generation of young people had to come through them. And, over the course of the next, 3 to 5 years, the company began having children. Mm-hmm. And in a series of big kids and little kids, those born in the early 70s and us in the late 70s. And a part of the mission and the vision of healing community through theater was how to raise these babies, right? Like, mm-hmm. we were a part of the antidote to how we heal our stories is how much love and care and culture we pour into the next generation. So my mom started a school in National Black Theater that from the time we could crawl, we were in this school that was dedicated to God conscious art, as it was called. Our acronym was SIDIG. And it was about a dozen young people and children. Now, I say by the time we got through the school, big kids were in third grade. The little kids were in like first grade. I don't know if I knew how to read per se, but I could sing. I could dance. I knew how to, conjure my ancestors and acknowledge them. Growing up in National Black Theater, there were always actors and writers and poets and activists coming through our doors, and a part of their journey of expressing and sharing community was helping to raise us. And so anyway, it was a wild adventure that took us, that toured our children's company around the country from New York to Seattle. I remember being raised with my mother. She had these self-care Tuesdays at our home where the likes of Felicia Rashad and Michelle Shays of the world and the Hattie Winstons would come over and be in community and take time out of all of the pressures that they found on the stage. They got to release some of that and be in sisterhood within our house. I remember long sessions with Nina Simone's and my mom getting into it around the dinner table with Amiri Baraka. Baldwin was a neighbor. So, I mean, it was an incredible world. My mom was also a Delta. And so some of the greats like Maya Angelou and Dr. Betty Shabazz, I remember as my aunties who were her sisters in the sorority, not knowing any of those names that I've just listed were and are the great cultural icons of our, of our world. For me, it was just my crazy aunties and uncles and, this community of artists that really took a frontline responsibility in raising us as children. And so it was a wild ride, but it was an incredibly rich and rewarding adventure in understanding first and foremost, before I was exposed to anything else in the world, that I mattered, that our culture and our stories matter, and that we, with the littlest of resources, could do and be anything we wanted to do and be in the world and make a difference.
That is absolutely amazing. I mean, Nina Simone.
Yep.
The names that you just mentioned are just people, some of them I was able to meet, to be in their presence. But James Baldwin was a neighbor. My goodness. Yeah. That was amazing. You stepped away from that to find your own way. And anyone who has seen you know that you have this amazing sense of style, and when you enter a room, people know that you have entered the room. You have worked in the fashion industry. How did you make that transition? Hearing what I just heard, I can understand why you were around all of these artists and how you would be attracted to that. But how did you make that transition into fashion from coming out of all of this richness of culture and love and awareness?
It was really a practical decision, I have to say. You know, from a very young age, I had innate ability to express myself through clothes and style. I remember I made my first wedding dress out of curtains when I was six. I always felt a little inadequate in the environment I grew up in because, you know, I didn't have the obvious creative talents of so many of the people that were around me. One of the young people in Sadig, our school, was the actor Donald Faison, whose parents were, you know, Nabi Donald Faison and Shirley Aduni Faison, who were founding company members. And, you know, Shun or Donald, from the time he got pushed out of his parents' womb, you know, his mom's womb, he was acting, he could sing, like he was so talented. And so I was really intimidated growing up around so many creative, self-identified artists. But the way that I was most expressed was through clothes. And I didn't realize that that was its own creative outlet. It was just something that I was good at. Mm-hmm. And, allowed me to tell stories and gave me a lane. So fast forward, I think through school, I was a very talented dancer. My mom is from East St. Louis, Illinois. My grandmother's college roommate was Catherine Dunham. And so we would spend our summers in East St. Louis and I'd get shipped off to Catherine Dunham School. And so dance became a really big part of my life. Until I got to the point where I was so good and one of my mom's close friends, I feel like I'm doing a lot of name dropping and I don't mean to, but this is just our community, was Alvin Ailey, and he had a junior company. And all of a sudden, as a adolescent, I felt like I was being formed and shaped to follow in my mother's footsteps, ironically, which as a 13-year-old girl is the last thing you want to do is be compared to your mother. Mm-hmm. So I ran as fast in the opposite direction as possible because there was no air for me in this path forward that was always shaded by the light, her light, right? I was always in the shadow. And so I was hanging out one afternoon, Washington Square Park, as a young teenager, and I got scouted by a designer. And they thought I had really great style. And there was something called a trend forecaster. And they thought I would be a really wonderful trend forecaster. And it was like a way to have access to quick cash. I got to take designer shopping, and three or four times a year, they would shop my closet. And I'd get to like go to, you know, I would lead focus groups, or focus groups would be built around my aesthetic. And I just thought that was the coolest thing, how to like earn some cash and get some free clothes. And so that was really my foray into fashion. All throughout high school, I was a trend forecaster for major big box brands like Levi's, like Gap. I never took it seriously. It was just something to do in order not to have a summer job, and to have a little bit more of independence because I had a little cash in the bank. So that's how fashion started for me. I went to graduated Riverdale Country School, went to NYU, knew coming out of NYU, I wanted to work in the music business, actually. Mm-hmm, I mean, mm-hmm. It was a double major, art history and English. Graduated, had interned in many different aspects of the music industry, but landed at music television at MTV. Mm-hmm. Really thought that my life career would be in television production because there was something about the creative nature of producing television. I was a producer on a show called TRL, which mm-hmm. was a seminal show in the early 2000s. that was fast paced and energetic. And every day we had different creative, we pitched different creative. And so I thought that that's what I wanted to do. And ironically, every time I would be on location, whether it was at the VMAs or some kind of award show, doing like red carpet interviews as a producer, someone would always note my style. And then I got offered to have a column in a magazine called People Magazine, launched a teen magazine called Teen People. Mm-hmm. So I got back into fashion by writing about it on a monthly basis in my own DIY column. And eventually I would leave MTV to start my own production company, realized how hard it was. And again, the practicality of wanting to make a little money, I started writing for fashion magazines and assisting some of my friends that were fashion stylists. And my friends happened to be at the time some of like the vanguard of fashion stylists who had like incredible clients, from working with anyone from like Annie Leibovitz regularly to covers of Vogue. And, you know, so I got a front row seat of what it was to style. And, you know, eventually that just carried me. And so I started being a stylist, working with folks like, you know, Lenny Kravitz, Moët Steff, Jamie Foxx, Solange, like, very long list of celebrity clients or gigs. And eventually that took me on tour with Lenny Kravitz, who I really see him as the bridge between how I got back to theater, really. Obviously, Lenny Kravitz's family comes from a long line of artists as well. Mm-hmm. And his mother, the great Roxy Roker, did, you know, was a visionary in the way that she bridged her passion for Black theater and her commercial success in the Jeffersons. And knowing Lenny, getting to know Lenny through our work was like our work together as a stylist, really was a homecoming of sorts for me, because we got to sit up late at night and talk about the things that really made our hearts sing, which was our mothers, you know. And I rediscovered the value of Black theater and the contribution to the beauty of the world through some of those late night conversations with Lenny. And Lenny actually is a seminal person in my life too, because after working for him for a period of time, I decided to launch my own fashion brand, a swimwear brand with two best friends. And eventually it would be Lenny who invited me to do one of his music videos, be in mm-hmm. one of his music videos, because the song was really inspired by so much of the time we spent together. And I remember being in Miami, sorry, this story is so long, Marcia, but I remember being in Miami at Swim Week, which is like the biggest sales convention for swimwear designers. And it was our second year selling. And I remember we were having an incredible sales day and, you know, Sports Illustrated had come by. They wanted to pull a bunch of suits. And I got this call from Lenny saying, I'm shooting this video in Paris. And I really would like you to fly out and be in the video. And I remember being like, I'm a businesswoman. I run a fashion brand. I can't go to Paris to be in a music video. Those days are over, you know? But I called my mom and I was like, Mom, what do I do? You know, I'm finally establishing myself as a CEO of this business, and which was a struggle. Like, it wasn't like we were successful out the gates. It was really a grind. It was a hustle. We built our brand from nothing, you know? And here is this very, you know, extravagant offer to fly to Paris. And my mom said, honey, when someone offers you Paris, you go to Paris. And he said, that's why you got two partners. And I said, are you sure? And she said, yes. I said, well, I don't have a pass. Like, my passport is back in Harlem. If I'm to go to Paris, like, you have to FedEx me my passport. And she took a deep breath and she said, oh, baby, I'm so tired. All right, I will find a way to FedEx you this, but I guess, Lord, I don't need another assignment on my plate. And And that was the last conversation I had with her. And then 5 a.m. that next morning, later that night, I got a call that she had passed away of a heart attack. And that changed my world. Obviously, I came back to New York right away. I had slowly started coming back to the theater because Woody King Jr. had invited me to be a part of a production that New Federal was doing. It was Ed Bullen's play called Urban Transitions, Loose Blossoms, where I would co-star with another newbie, who was Chadwick Boseman. And that happened a few years prior to my kind of story I was telling you about fashion. So I had slowly kind of started getting back into Black theater. The last year of my mom's life, unknowing that it was her last year, I started costume designing for some of the shows at MBT. And so when she passed, the board had asked me to step in for 6 months while they found someone that might be able to take the reins. This was really on the heels of also losing another huge giant at NBT, Tunde Allen Samuels, who had died a few years prior to my mother's passing. So, you know, NBT was really trying to get its bearings. I will say the irony of trying to figure out if I could say yes to this 6 months was, you know, we had this incredible homegoing service for my mom, filled with pageantry throughout Harlem, and it was overwhelming. And I remember coming back home to her house and how quiet it was, and sitting in that silence, and the doorbell rang. It was FedEx. I opened the FedEx envelope, and it was the envelope my mom had sent to Miami, had gotten rerouted back to her. And I opened it up, and it was my passport with a note that said, "Life is short, baby. Live it well." And I just felt like it was my mom communicating from the other side that life is short and live it well. And there was something that felt like my yes was a part of how I'm going to live my life well. And so I said yes to 6 months, and I've been here ever since.
And we are glad that you have said yes. And on the other side of the break, we will talk about what you have said yes to. This is Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Marcia Pendleton, your host. And we're back with CEO of National Black Theater, Sade Lithcott. And we're going to talk about a brief history. She's going to give us a brief history of National Black Theater and talk about its mission and some of the things that are happening for NBT today that include being on Broadway and off Broadway. And before you answer that question, I want to say congratulations that Fat Ham has been recognized this season, culminating in 5 Tony Award nominations and won an Outer Critics Circle Award for Best American Play, New American Play. Yep. So for the Pulitzer Prize winning piece called Fat Ham. So we'll circle back to that, but let's start with a history of NBT.
Yeah, so National Black Theater is the longest continually run Black theater in New York City, founded in 1968, like I was saying before, by a visionary artist and entrepreneur, Dr. Barbara Ann Teer. Dr. Teer founded National Black Theater, deliberately left her career on Broadway to move to Harlem because she saw that Black theater in particular was an incredible vehicle to have conversations around Black liberation in service of human transformation, and that the power of storytelling could heal us as a people and our communities nationwide. And so our focus has always been to produce, develop, nurture contemporary Black theater makers in the articulation of the authentic Black lifestyle experience, to counter balance the lies and the contortion of Black lifestyle and identity through a mainstream lens. And so we do our programs. We have three core programs. Our theater arts program, which is what we're probably the most famous for, that would be our main stage shows, our public presentations and special events. Our communication arts program, which has been recently renamed Alternative Learning and Social Impact. And that is all of our work that we do with young people, education. Dr. Tier's take on education was that we're all lifelong learners. So this incorporates everything from our dramaturgical lobby exhibits to bringing Little Amal to Harlem or silent discos like Learn to Love Yourself, where we commission artists to create affirmation sonic landscapes for our people and community to see themselves reflected back at their highest. And then lastly, which is less prevalent right now because we're in the middle of a huge capital redevelopment project, but the entrepreneurial arts program, which is seminal to who National Black Theater is. Dr. Tier bought the city block of 125th mm-hmm. Street and Fifth Avenue in 1983. And because of the nature of what it is that we do, this bold, fearless, unapologetic Blacks theater making and storytelling, she designed a business model that where the real estate would subsidize the arts so that we weren't reliant on individual donors, foundations, and philanthropy to be able to tell the story how we tell our stories, which is ironic because as she talks about that, in this last Beyonce album, Renaissance, mm-hmm. Beyonce samples my mom talking mm-hmm. specifically about mm-hmm. how we do things uniquely. And in order not to have that unique perspective of Black folks showing up for Black folks, you know, this FUBU for us, by us, our real estate has always been our leverage to a lot of our entrepreneurial freedom. And so those are the three core programs of National Black Theater. It is the work that we do. As of 2008, early 2009, I stepped in as the current CEO. Shortly thereafter, in 2012, I invited my partner in crime, Jonathan McCrory, to come on board. He started out as the director of theater arts program, and through both of our growth through stewarding NBT, is now the executive artistic director of National Black Theater. And he and I get the great privilege to continue the legacy and steward National Black Theater into the future.
That is absolutely amazing. I remember reading some of your mother's work when I was in graduate school. That's how I was introduced to Dr. Barbara Ann Tier. And when I finally got a chance to meet her, it was just like a real fangirl moment. It was like, oh my God, I read your work. But just an absolutely amazing and vital history. Let's talk a little bit about the partnerships that you've developed. You mentioned a bit earlier when you were talking about the mission and the history and the core programs, that you're in the midst of a capital project. And so that means that while this building is going up, there is no space to create theater in that space. So how have you been creating theater during this entire time? You like coming out of a pandemic, which, you know, we're still in it, you know, really and truly, but coming out of the lockdown and being able to produce theater again. So who are some of your producing partners and how have you managed that?
Yeah, so, you know, before Dr. Tier made her transition to the other side, she was really clear that in order to create a sustainable National Black Theater for future generations, a capital project would be required. And so I think one of the things, I'm so happy to be on your show to clear up some of the misconceptions, because I know for so many of the folks that have been our family and community and audience members for over a half century, see the rapid growth and think that somehow, you know, myself and or Jonathan are taking MBT in a new direction. And the truth of the matter is the blueprint that people get to witness of MBT was really created and set in stone by Dr. Barbara Antier herself. And so she had started the process of looking at rezoning our building and finding the right development partner to create a catalytic force and ecosystem where Black artists, local artists could live, work, and serve within their own community, which was always her footprint. So saying all that to say, it all came together in early 2020. So the wild part of this is, as we are about to sign with our developer, this pandemic hits simultaneously. And so the collision of pandemic and demolition of our old building and space for this visionary project to move forward happened literally at the same time. And so while folks were closing their theater, we were literally moving out of our space, preparing it to be leveled so that we could build this future home away from home. And so that caused us to be itinerant. And so we as a theater will be back on 125th and Fifth Avenue in 2026. But until then, we launched something through the pandemic that was essential, not only to how to work through a pandemic where you can't be in person with each other, and through the transition of building our new space called NBT Beyond Walls. And so through the pandemic, that started out as a digital program that partnered with different organizations, including, you know, the Schomburg Center for Black Culture and Research. And eventually when we could be back in person, NBT Beyond Walls found ourselves doing local partnerships with the Apollo Theater, the Schomburg, but also opening it up to citywide partners like the New York Philharmonic last season, partnerships all over the country and the city. Fat Ham was a part of our last season off-Broadway in a co-production with the Public Theater. Dreaming Zenzile was a new musical directed by Liliana Blaine Cruz that we co-produced with New York Theater Workshop, which has also been nominated for many awards this season. We're so proud of it. And so every season moving forward, until we can get back into our own space, we've created this template of MBT Beyond Walls that partners with organizations throughout the city. This season, we have partnered with Rattlestick Theater to bring the world premiere of Amani. We are now in production with the new group, bringing a world premiere of a new show by Diane Xavier called Bernarda's Daughter. And we will be having a public presentation of one of our playwrights in residence, Fedna Jacquet, at in partnership with the Flea Theater at the end of the season. So that's kind of how it works. Every season leading up to getting back into our space, we'll have these compelling co-produced productions. And the idea and the theory is that Black theater should be in all communities. And Black theater that is for us, by us, shaped by producers that look like us, that care about the quality of our experience, should be at the helm and find ourselves in both Black and white spaces. And the hope is we bring those audiences and that energy back to Harlem when we are ready to open our doors.
Okay, so I would love to speak a little bit about Fat Ham and the way that I was introduced to Saheem Ali, the director, the Tony nominated director, and James Imes, Pulitzer Prize winner. And it was through the National Black Theater. And it was through a production called Kill Move Paradise. And as I will tell anybody, that when I saw that particular production, it was just 65 minutes, but it was 65 of the most intense moments of theater that I have ever experienced. It was amazing. So that relationship was nurtured by NBT. Talk about that.
Yeah. So the irony, and thank you for asking the question, this incredible company of artists that has made this phenomena of Fat Ham, a lot of them met at National Black Theater. So around 7 years ago, MBT season theme was In Pursuit of Black Joy. So much of our mission, as we said, was to articulate the authenticity of Black lifestyle. And at the time, you know, the radio waves and the media waves were showing the killings of all these young Black men and women at the hands of state violence. And it was the summer of Mike Brown and Tamir Rice. And, you know, what we believed as artistic curators were that what our community needed was space to heal and be human, and that the antithesis of this kind of trauma porn that was happening on our televisions that left us, you know, raw and wrought and encapsulated our whole lives as hashtags, needed more space to be in pursuit of what healing might look like for us. And so that season was In Pursuit of Black Joy. You know, one of the spaces that Jonathan has always been really reliant on to find new voices was an incredible space that we miss dearly called The Lark. And so, you know, Jonathan was in conversation with The Lark, give me some new playwrights that I should be thinking about, should be on my radar. And he came into contact with James Imes' writing. And if you've ever read a James play, you know that he is brilliant. And Kill Move Paradise was this incredible 65-minute ride that looks at these young men who were taken by state violence. But the play starts in the moment that they were ripped from Earth and land them into purgatory, which is that set was designed by Maruti Evans, who is the set designer for Fat Ham. It brought Maruti, Saheem, and James together. Everyone met through this production. We had been watching so much of, you know, Saheem had not had a major production in New York before Kill Move Paradise, but we had tasked him to direct a reading of Jocelyn Bio's, one of the first readings of Jocelyn Bio's Nollywood Dreams at NBT. And seeing him in that room was transfixing, and we were familiar with some of his other work. And so we had wanted to work with Saheem for a while. He said yes to this project. James hadn't had a New York premiere or project ever. He said yes to it. And so Saheem and James met through our world premiere production of Kill Move Paradise. That's where Daryl, our incredible choreographer for Kill Move Paradise, also became a lifelong co-conspirator and partner with Saheem. He was our choreographer on Fat Ham.
Daryl Moultrie, correct?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. And Maruti created this surreal mirrored world for Kill Move Paradise. And the thing about Kill Move Paradise is this mirrored slide that all of the young men come in on is a water slide. So we had to build a water slide in Harlem in National Black Theater. And so all of those incredible creatives got their start. Many of them got their start at MBT, found family in the way that we produced together. And when this project came on board, you know, the leadership of Saheem Ali was, let's bring the family back together. And so that's how a lot of the creative team for Fat Ham came to be.
This is Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Marcia Pendleton, your host. Before we return to our conversation, let's listen to the snippet of words spoken by Dr. Barbara Ann Teer and used by Beyoncé on Alien Superstar from her acclaimed album, Renaissance.
Dress a certain way, we walk a certain way, we talk a certain way, we paint a certain way, we make love a certain way. You know, all of these things we do in a different, unique, specific way that is personally ours.
And we're back with the CEO of National Black Theater, Sade Lithcott. And this is the third and final part of our conversation about NBT. So the question I want to ask right now is, what have you learned about yourself since leading NBT? I'm speaking that into existence for you too.
Yes. Oh, wow. What a big question to end on. One, I've learned that the universe is always unfolding for your greatest good. I have learned that life, universe, whatever you have faith in, believe in, is always preparing you for your life's work. I didn't realize that as a young child, I was being groomed and prepared for all that would be ahead of me. Even in the running away from the theater was really a part of how I came home to the theater. And I would say, I've learned a lot about, I don't want to say this. I was going to say I've learned a lot about how strong I am and how resilient I am. But I think as Black women, we know that all too often. And I would like us to know that less. But I'll tell you a very short story because I know we're at the end of time. When my mom passed away, Dr. Maya Angelou had written a poem, a bit of a eulogy for her. And she couldn't deliver it herself because she herself was not in good health. And so she sent it along, as everyone knows, in her handwriting on her stationery to be read by Avery Brooks at my mom's homegoing ceremony. I remember being in that front row, intimidated by and filled with grief. And all of these luminaries from Ruby Dees to the Miri Barakas and Sonia Sanchez's getting on that mic and speaking their truth of their experience of Dr. Tear. And some of the stories were stories I had heard from the first time. And I remember instead of being lifted, I started to shrink. And it culminated with this poem that Auntie Maya had written. And, you know, it started out, you know, she's one of one. She's unique. No one should try to fill her shoes. You can't, right? The gist of it was that no one could do what she did. No one should attempt retire the jersey. And I remember listening to those words as if it was a nail in my own coffin, because what I had to do the next day was to try to fill her shoes. Mm. Like that was what I was being tasked with. And the greatest people on earth were saying it was impossible. And so for the beginning of my leadership in my tenure at NBT, I can safely say I was in a torrid affair with imposter syndrome, trying to figure out how to do and be all the things my mom was to both individuals in our community at large and sector at large. And it wasn't until Auntie Maya passed away that I revisited her words so that I posted them on Instagram, her writing, and it became the key to unlock the cage that I had felt imprisoned to, which was that I can't be my mom. And I guess that's my greatest lesson. I can't be anybody but me, and that I have unique gifts, a unique perspective and point of view that is a part of completing the sentence of my ancestors' vision and wildest dreams, and that each of us contribute something to the continuum of our own family and countries and cultures' legacy, that we are each legacy bearers, regardless of who we are related to, and that we can leave our own imprint. And that imprint is not singular, that the work that we do is movement work, and movement work moves and it builds on each other. And so in revisiting Dr. Angelou's words, Maya's words, my biggest lesson is that I have to be me, and I have to, you know, stand proudly on the shoulders of those who came before me, but reach into the unimagined space of the future so that someone else can stand on my own shoulders. And so I guess that's my biggest life lesson, is just to be unapologetic around your unique gifts and contributions. And we all can do that.
Are you sharing this insight with your son? I believe the last time I saw him, he was 3 years old, and now he is 6 years old. Running into people now, 3 years later, after being away from folks, how are you sharing that information with your precious light?
Well, I have to say, unlike me as a small kid, Thelonious has so much pride in being a part of the National Black Theater. He has run to it. And the incredible staff and family of National Black Theater is raising this boy as I was raised. And I'm sharing it with him because what I got to see mapped for me is that nothing is impossible, that impossible is I'm possible. And as a little Black boy, I just want to pour into him all of the possibilities of the world, whether that finds himself in theater or not. And the deep pride that he feels going to see Fat Ham as a six-year-old and understanding that the stories that he's seeing on stage are a reflection not only of mommy's labor and the thing that takes her away from him, but is a compass to the unimagined future that he gets to paint for himself in all of the colors that are in his toolbox. And so I am, and our village is imparting all of those things on him on a daily basis. And he, unlike me, is soaking it up. And that's really wonderful to see.
And how would people connect with, support, uplift, continue to uplift this amazing legacy of National Black Theater?
Oh, family, family, family. You can join National Black Theater. You can join this historic moment and movement by going to our website, which is nationalblacktheater.org, or joining these conversations on our social platforms, on Instagram at Nat Black Theater, on Twitter. Join our YouTube page. We want to know who our family is. And great visions like Dr. Barbara Ann Teer are not held singularly by one person. It is the space and it is the drum of the village. So we need you. We are building a incredible new space that we have to raise over $70 million to build the state-of-the-art Black Theater in Harlem, and we can't do it without you. So you can find out more about the project and all of our work on our website.
Thank you so very much for taking the time to spend with me today in conversation. I know how busy you are, but I really and truly appreciate it and you. Thank you so much.
I love you so much, Marcia. Thank you so much for the opportunity. It was an honor.
National Black Theater's NBT Beyond Walls currently has Fat Ham playing on Broadway at the American Airlines Theater. Bernarda's Daughters, a co-production with a new group running off-Broadway, and Black Mother, Lost Daughter, coming soon to the Flea Theater. For more information, visit nationalblacktheater.org, nationalblacktheater.org, and you spell theater with an R-E. Join us on Thursdays at 9 p.m. for Backstage Stories. I'm Marcia Pendleton. Thank you for listening. We are going to leave you with more music by the iconic voice and presence of Tina Turner. Thank you, Queen. Rest well.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a celebration. The award-winning Midnight Ravers can now be heard every Friday from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. So wake the town and tell the people. We'll continue to present the best in music, history, and social commentary, along with expert discussion of the important issues and events of today and yesteryear. So keep it locked into WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
WBAI accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.